As we begin this morning, I want you to know that I love you, and I am going to encourage us to love one another. And you say, well, that's easy, Scott, because you're so lovable. No, I said I want to encourage us, I want to challenge us to love one another. Some of you know that early in my ministry, I was an associate pastor at a small Bible church in Colorado Springs. It was so small that I had to work a job outside the church to pay the bills. And so I worked in a bank doing lots of different jobs to include consumer lending, primarily second mortgages or car loans or boat loans or motorcycle loans, credit cards, and so I would spend the day taking credit applications and running and reading those credit reports. As you may know, the credit report shows who you owe, how much you owe, how current your payments are. That is, are you making your payments on time? And then they've come to give a credit score. Found that all to be very interesting to see the financial strength or more likely the financial mess that people were making of their lives. I found also that people would be really nice to me when they first came into the office and were filling out those applications asking for money. But then after I read their credit reports and had to call them or meet with them and tell them no, well, they weren't always so nice. After 9 years at Colorado National Bank, I started working with a Christian financial institution, a Christian bank. That may sound a bit like an oxymoron, I know, but you have to understand that in Colorado Springs, there were about 80 national and international ministry organizations, not unlike Samaritan's Purse, plus hundreds of evangelical churches, some of them very large, and this Christian bank offered financial services to evangelical organizations and their staffs. And they thought, they contacted me, they thought that having a pastor banker as a manager would work nicely, and I naively thought things would be different. You see, I thought Christians would manage their finances better. And I thought that they would be nicer if you had to tell them no. And I was wrong on both counts. Now, I suspect that they were facing equal or even worse financial challenges for two reasons. Well, they were Christians, and so they actually gave part of their income to God. I mean, think about it. If you give, I don't know, let's just say 10% to God, you might not be able to afford the boat, but that didn't keep them from trying. And secondly, working at ministry organizations didn't always pay as well as their counterparts in secular organizations. But the temptation was still there to keep up with the Joneses. And so they learned to live beyond their means just like everybody else. And by the way, keeping up with the Joneses is defined as buying things you don't need with money you don't have from people you don't know to keep up with people you don't even like. Again, I also found that when I had to tell them no, that they weren't always nice. You know, when they first came into my office, we'd talk a lot about Christian stuff, you know, church and the work of the kingdom that they happen to be doing around the world. But then in that inevitable follow-up visit or phone call, when I regularly had to tell them, I'm sorry, I can't help you, that Christian talk would sometimes vanish. Now, I suppose that was for a couple of reasons as well. First, I guess they expected a Christian bank would be more benevolent in their lending guidelines, kind of like a benevolence committee. And second, I guess it was the financial pressure from making less money and giving part of it to God, that whole tithing thing. I want to suggest to you that I should have found things different, better. Maybe not so much on the financial side, although Christians ought to be better managers of our finances, since we understand that we're merely stewards of what God has entrusted to our care, and that there is coming a day when we will give an account of our stewardship. But beyond that, we ought to be different in the way we act. I should have been able to expect them and receive different treatment when they came in. We ought to be different, both inside the church and outside in the world. Scott Burns, a few weeks ago, talked to us about this. He said we ought to have a Christian accent. In the very way that we talk, people ought to be able to tell that we're different. Not weird, not in a bad way, in a good way, we're different. The Apostle Paul says as much in our text today, in our continuing study of the book of Romans. Read it with me. Three short verses. Romans chapter 13, verses 8 and following say this: "Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law." Paul has been describing for us what a life transformed by the gospel looks like, and has been a fairly challenging list. First, he says we need to think rightly about ourselves, which means we don't think too much or too highly of ourselves. And then that frees us up to think of others in the body of Christ and to serve them with our spiritual gifts. And then Paul says we need to be people who love sincerely. He followed that with a number of one another commands that were primarily directed within the church family, but he didn't stop there. He says we also need to think of others rightly outside the body, outside the church family. We need to bless them. That is, we don't curse them. We don't seek revenge. In short, we overcome evil, their evil, with our good. Which brought us to last week. We also are to submit to governing authorities. We're to pay what is due them, as Paul reminded us, taxes and fear and honor. So with that rather challenging list, Paul had talked about our relationship with ourselves, if you will, with those around us in the church family, with those around us outside the church family, and then those above us in authority. And now he sums all of that up and gives us this command to love. You see, love is the sine qua non of the Christian faith. Love is to govern every relationship that we enjoy. Now, there's actually a verbal tie to last week's sermon. We didn't just jump off a bridge there from verse 7 to verse 8. And it's in the word debt or due. In verse 7, he said, pay to the governing authorities what is due them. You have a debt, so pay it. Taxes, fear, and honor. In fact, he goes on, let no debt remain outstanding. Well, except one, the ongoing debt to love one another. Let me give you the brief outline of this text. We're going to look, love's the debt, and love fulfills the law, and love does no wrong. It's really a rather straightforward and yet highly significant text today. Love is supposed to be what sets us apart as followers of Christ. Say that again. Love is supposed to be what sets us apart as followers of Christ. So here's a question for you to consider. You know, I like to ask you questions for you to kind of be rumbling around in your brain. If I ask those who know you best, people you live with, maybe the people who live next to you, people you work with or go to school with, the people who know you best, to write down two or three qualities that describe you, here's the question: would love make the list? Let me just let that settle for a minute. Are you seen as a loving person? I have to tell you that I'm preaching this sermon as much to me as I am to you, because it is confessedly true of me that I am perhaps more known for my unbending commitment to orthodoxy and doctrine than I am known for love. Don't misunderstand me. I should be committed to truth, but it should always, my actions and my attitudes and my words should always be governed by love. Does love make the list? See, as Scott read to us a few moments ago, Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment in the law? What's on the list? And the people asking were the Orthodox ones, and they would have expected Jesus to quote one of the Ten Commandments. I mean, don't have any other gods before God, or more likely, the one they like, keep the Sabbath. But Jesus didn't say that. Instead, he quoted Deuteronomy chapter 6, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Then he threw in a second commandment for good measure, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's a quote of Leviticus 19, and it's the one that Paul quotes here. Love is the sine qua non of the faith. Sine qua non is a Latin phrase that means, I want you to get this, without which it could not be. Without which there is nothing. Basically, what it means is that this is essential. So what I'm saying, I want you to write this down, without love, Christianity could not be. Without love, Christianity is nothing. Which means if people write down those two or three qualities about you and love doesn't make the list, you're not much of a Christian. Sounds a bit strong, I know. It's what Paul said. 1 Corinthians 13, he said, if I have all of the spiritual gifts, let's say the gift of faith, so that I could move mountains, get lost, and I don't have love, I am nothing. Without love, Christianity is nothing. Jesus said love is the greatest commandment. Jesus said God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. Jesus said greater love is no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. Love is the, we see from those verses, love is the motivation and basis by which God sent his son. And love is the motivation and basis by which the Son laid down his life. Love is essential to Christianity. Without love, you got nothing. And where would we be without love? Love is essential to the Christian faith. So I say to me, as much as to you, while love without orthodoxy or truth maybe mere sentimentality, so also, Scott, orthodoxy without love is cold, hard, heartless, and lifeless. Love is a debt. Paul said it this way, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. Now, he's not forbidding borrowing there, but he's implying that Christians repay any debt they incur. Leave no debts unpaid. Well, except one. Love is a debt you can never pay off. It is a debt that is always outstanding. In fact, think of it this way. As Paul pointed out, you maybe mailed your taxes last week, or maybe you're going to pay them tomorrow, such that you'll be able to say, they're paid. And for that moment, you'll be able to say, I don't owe the government anything right now. Well, you know, except for the $14.3 trillion. Maybe at some point in your life, you paid off your house, and you burned your mortgage, and you don't owe the bank anymore. I want you to know that's wonderful. But there is one debt that you will always have, and it is the debt of love. Ongoing. An early church father said it this way, let your only debt that is unpaid be that of love. But it's a debt that you should always be attempting to discharge in full, but will never succeed in discharging. In other words, we can never, would you listen, we can never get to the point where we say, I've loved you enough. I don't have to love you anymore. I've done all the loving I need to do. Well, we don't actually say it in precisely those words, but we communicate it with our actions, don't we? We put up with people, certain people, for so long. You know, those annoying people. There are limits to our love. I will love you this far, this much, and no more. This is all you get from me. So Paul is saying, you never get to the point where you can say, I've loved you enough, no more love for you. Listen, you can't do that. The ledger is always in the red. You still owe. The payment book is still full of payment coupons. Okay? Remember that all-you-can-eat pancake commercial? You take a bite out and then it fills back up? That's the way it is with your love coupon book. Pull out a coupon, a love coupon, give it to somebody. Your book is still full. But far from being onerous or discouraging, we are to remember how much we are loved. And with that, we love. Because do you know that God never says to you, no more love for you? Aren't you glad? We love because he first loved us and never stops loving us. True love, Christian love, never ceases. Now, I know, because we're people of exceptions. I can think of all kinds of exceptions or examples or excuses by which we can withhold love. And I understand that there may be a sense in which that is true. Sometimes the most loving thing that we can do is to show tough love, but would you please notice it's still love, allowing people to endure the consequences of their choices. But even then, this expression of love must be done as a selfless love for them, not a disguised form of vengeance. Some of you have withheld love from people and mislabeled it tough love when in fact you're just getting even. In fact, you're just out of love, and the book's still full. So right now, here's a little exercise for you. I want you to think of the person you are most tired of. That didn't help. How about this? Think of the most annoying person in your life. Immediately, you had a face pop into your brain. The one to whom you have said or thought, no more love for you. Now, I want you to see that the payment book is still full. Tear out a payment coupon, and there's another, and there's another, and there's another. Love is a never satisfied debt. I know you can grow weary with the weight of love. Keep loving. Who exactly is the one another here? I don't think that we can ignore Paul's use of one another in chapters 12 and 13 to refer primarily to the Christian family. So when he says love one another, I do think that he's saying love those in the church. I'm not speaking generally. Okay, I got to love Christians. I want you to look around the room. You need to love your brothers and sisters. And I've said this before, but I'm going to say it again. Some of you think, well, I do love people in the church. There are just some of them I can't stand. There's just some of them I don't like. I want to ask you again, as I have before, what exactly does that mean? I love you, but I don't like you. I want to suggest to you, you can't do that. I know there are people who annoy you. Get over it. Are you saying that I have to hang out with those annoying people? No, I understand that there are close friendships and affinities and relationships. But if you find yourself in a place where a lot of people are annoying you, have you ever stopped to consider that you might just be the annoying person? Can we at least be loving brothers and sisters? We must love, and I'm going to add, like one another. Now, I think he broadens it when he uses the word neighbor in the next phrase, and he quotes Leviticus 19. He says, he who loves his neighbor, not just other Christians, has fulfilled the law. And certainly Leviticus 19 refers to those outside the family. How do I know that? Well, because when Jesus quoted it, he illustrated it by telling the story of the Good Samaritan. Remember that? Luke chapter 10. Someone asked Jesus, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus said, well, what's the law say? And the guy answered with the so-called great commandments. Love God with heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus said, that's a good answer. Do that, and you'll have eternal life. Of course, Jesus understood he couldn't do that perfectly. He still needed the gospel. That's beside the point. The guy follows it up with another question. Well, who's my neighbor? In other words, tell me who I don't have to love. Draw some boundaries for me, Jesus, because there's some really annoying people. There's some people that I don't like. And Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan, illustrating that a Samaritan proved to keep this law by caring for a Jew. And you have to understand that Samaritans and Jews did not consider themselves neighbors. They hated each other. In other words, the debt to love others doesn't stop with those in the family. It extends to those with whom you come in contact with every day, loving others inside and outside the family. Here's the point. We are to be known as loving people. Here's my question. When people think of Alliance Bible Fellowship and they write down the two or three qualities that describe us, what would they write? Bible teaching church, big church. I mean, would love make the list? Why is love so important? Because secondly, Paul says love fulfills the law. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. He's not saying that love replaces the law, like, you know, all you need is love. You know, you love and that's all you need to do. No, he's saying that if you love, you will fulfill or keep the moral demands of the law, what some call the law of Christ. Paul illustrates, for this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, he knew there was, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Several thoughts about that. Paul lists four of the Ten Commandments, four of those which address our horizontal relationships. You know that the first four of the Ten Commandments are directed toward the vertical relationship with God. Verse 4, no other gods before him, no graven images, that is, no idols. Don't take his name in vain. Remember his Sabbath. So when Jesus said the greatest commandment is to love God with heart, soul, mind, and strength, that means everything, he was summing up these first four commandments. You see, if you love God with all your being is the idea, you won't have other gods before him, even that boat. And you won't worship idols. You won't take his name in vain to profane and dishonor it, and you will remember the Sabbath command to honor and worship him. The next six commandments have to do with our horizontal relationships with others. He says, honor your parents. No murder, no adultery, no stealing, no false witness or lying, no coveting. In Romans 13 now, Paul lists four of these, not necessarily in order, no adultery, no murder, no stealing, and no coveting. Then he throws in that catch-all phrase, and if there is any other commandment, again, he knew there was, he's just summing it all up. All of these horizontal relationships can be summed up in the one command in Leviticus 19, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And if you stop to think about it, it makes sense. If you love your neighbor, two of whom happen to be your parents, you'll honor them. If you love your neighbor, you won't Well, you won't murder him. If you love your neighbor, you won't commit adultery with his wife. You won't steal from him. You won't lie to him or about him. And you won't covet what he has. Do you see how love is the foundation of the commandments? Love, then, is the motivation of doing what is right. This is to be the foundation of our obedience. If you love, you will do what is right. Inasmuch as you don't love or don't love enough, you will not do what is right. I say this to my brothers at Freedom Farm that I get to meet with on Wednesday nights, and I tell them rather regularly, and they were here the last service. I don't tell them to start. Freedom Farm, by the way, is a drug and alcohol program teaching you how to be fully devoted followers of Christ, okay? Drug and alcohol recovery program. And I tell them, I won't start by telling you, stop doing drugs. I don't start with, stop getting drunk. I asked them, they were all sitting here. I said, how many of you knew that doing drugs was against the law? All of them raise your hands. They don't need more law. Stop. The place to start is love God. Love Jesus. And if you love him enough, you will stop doing drugs. And you'll stop doing alcohol. You see, love is a foundation. Love for God is a foundation. I can then say, stop doing this or start doing that. I could say the same thing to you. You being a jerk to your spouse or your kids, I won't start with stop being a jerk. I'll start with love God and love people who happen to be your spouse and your kids. If you do, you'll stop being a jerk. You having trouble with anger or with lust or with lying or pride? Well, love God and love people and you'll stop. Jesus himself said the same thing. Our love for him is the basis of our obedience. If you love me, Jesus said, you'll do what I command. Meaning, conversely, if you don't love me, you won't do what I command. So, inasmuch as you love Jesus, which is the place to start, you will do what he says. You'll obey him. Conversely, and I know this is a little bit hard to hear, inasmuch as you love yourself or your sin more, you will disobey. In fact, I will say it like this. When you sin, you are saying to Jesus, I love my sin more than you, Jesus. See, I don't like the way that's what Jesus said. You're at least saying you don't love Jesus enough. So also with one another. When you sin against them, you are saying, I love myself more than I love you. If I loved you first and most, I would not sin against you. And so love becomes the fulfillment of the law. Let me address this love your neighbor as yourself idea. Some come to this and want to say something like, you must love yourself before you can love others. Or self-love is the foundation of others' love. Some even go so far as to say, this is a command to love ourselves. None of that is actually true. God, through Moses in Leviticus 19, was not commanding self-love. Jesus and Paul were not saying you must start with self-love. The truth is, they were presupposing that we do love ourselves, and in most cases, that's the problem. We love ourselves too much. I take you back to the beginning of this whole section. Quit thinking of yourselves too much and too highly. Think of others. Love others. Paul, in fact, uses the word agape, which speaks of a self-sacrificing love. Love your neighbor self-sacrificially. As you love yourself sacrificially, doesn't even really make sense. So, with loving yourself as an assumption, not a command, Paul says, you know, since you love yourself, why don't you love your neighbor like you love yourself? And as you do, you will fulfill the law. Which leads to the third, very quickly, rather obvious point. Love does no wrong, verse 10. verse actually begins and ends with the word love for emphasis. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Therefore, the fulfillment of the law is love. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. To do wrong to a neighbor would be to break one of these horizontal commands. To murder would be to rob your neighbor of life. Adultery robs them of their exclusive right to fidelity. To steal would rob them of possessions. To covet is to rob them of the joy of those possessions. And then Jesus took it a bit further. He said, to be angry with someone is to be guilty of murder, since anger is the attitude behind murder. So you harbor that seething, hateful, vengeful anger toward another person, that is to wrong them. Yeah, but I didn't pick up the knife. That didn't matter. Jesus said to lust is to be guilty of adultery, since lust is the sinful attitude behind adultery. So to lust would be to wrong them. Coveting is the attitude behind stealing, wanting what is not yours. So coveting would be to wrong them. You get the idea. We love them in actions, yes, by not doing the deed, but we also love them in our attitudes, in our minds, by thinking right thoughts, not having sinful thoughts against them. Love your neighbor as yourself. And so, you have a debt. You have a debt that will never be paid off. It is forever. To love one another, to love your neighbor as yourself. So let me close with this illustration. Let's take a moment to pull a spiritual credit report and see how you're doing. Remember that credit report shows who you owe, how much you owe, and it shows your payment history. So, your spiritual credit report would show who you owe. We've seen that's just about everybody. It's your neighbor. It's everyone around you. How much you owe? Well, that's a never satisfied debt. How about your payment history? Are your payments current? Would love make the list of your qualities? How's your credit score? Are you loving your neighbor in very tangible and self-sacrificing ways? Let's stand for prayer. Father, there are many times that as I preach your word, that the words are directed more at me than others. Father, I have been hammered by this truth this week. I want to be a fully devoted follower of Christ who has love on the list, who demonstrates that I love you and that I love people. And I want us as a church to be known as a loving body of believers. Orthodox, yes. Faithful, yes. Loving. Loving people here and loving people in our community. Father, would you help us to raise our credit score? Would you help us to be focused more on one another? Fill us with your Spirit so that the fruit of the Spirit, the first of which is love, may be evident in our lives. In Christ's name.